It's time. Time for stimulating talk. Time for thought-provoking conversation. Time for the Lisa Wexler Show on WICC 600. Turn on your brain and get the real scoop on today's topics and events. Here is Lisa Wexler.
And welcome to the show today. Well, we've got a serious but interesting and yet fun show. 203-333-9422 is our number. 203-333-9422. And you know that I have always been accused of being a little bit nasal in tone. That comes from my New York background. You didn't know? And that is apparently part and parcel of the New York regionalism, which has to do with a lot of speaking through the nose. But today, I'm speaking through the nose a little bit more than usual because I am full-blown leaking everywhere from the eyes, the nose, the ears. So it's really fun. No, not the ears, but the eyes and the nose. And therefore, if I huch and schnuch a little bit, you'll have to help me out by calling into the show and picking up the slack. 203-333-9422. We really do have a great show for you today. We have a retired multi-star general. Let me see how many stars he's got. David Pittard is joining us in the next hour. And Dana Pittard, he was the rank of major general, retired after 34 years of active duty service. And he was the person chosen to lead the initial U.S. response to halt the spread of ISIS in Iraq in 2014. He's written a new book about that in the wake of the capturing of al-Baghdadi. And, you know, I thought it was important once in a while to hear from the people who were literally on the front lines, because this war that we've been fighting essentially since 2001 in Iraq and Afghanistan as it spread throughout the Middle East seems interminable. And every time a president does something, whether it be Obama or Trump, they get criticized from one flank or another. So I wanted to speak to the general in the next hour, in this hour, pardon me, at 10:30, and hear from him a true perspective on how is our foreign policy being managed, where's it going, and what's the ultimate aim? 203-333-9422. In the next hour, we're going to hear from Themis Claridis. So Themis is from the House side of things. I know yesterday I heard Len Fasano on Paul Pacelli's show in the afternoon, and I think Len is going to join us here on Monday. And Len Fasano, representing the Senate, has put forth a proposal on behalf of the Republican Senate that the Republican House, in other words, the minority, the ranking Republicans, they were not involved, the House and Senate. We're going to hear from Themis at 11 o'clock why that was, that they weren't doing this collaboratively. But nonetheless, the plan on its own is something we're going to get into right now. We're going to drill down into it. And then in the next hour, we'll ask Themis how, if in any way, the House Republicans' plan would differ from the Senate Republicans' plan, and whether or not the Republicans can be united with respect to one plan going forward to Governor Lamont. And maybe we have the makings of what we call a compromise, where not everybody is completely happy and not everybody gets everything they wanted, but people get enough of what they needed in order for us to move forward. And you know what? That's life. And that's the way government is supposed to work. It's the old eighth grade checks and balances. So I'm sort of excited about this. So that's what I want to begin with today. 203-333-9422 as we drill down into what did the Republicans propose vis-a-vis a new transportation plan for Connecticut? And let me at the outset just say that I think it feels like a sort of breath of fresh air in Connecticut right now. Because Governor Malloy was a very, very unpopular governor. I think he was the most unpopular governor among all the governors by the time he left office. And I don't mean to besmirch him personally or professionally. I never did on the air, and I certainly never would. But he only had a 26% approval rating. And he was perceived, this I know to be true, he was perceived by many people in Hartford as somebody who was a my way or the highway kind of a guy. His personality was described as abrasive. Well, we've got Governor Lamont, and whatever you can say about him in terms of his policies, he is never described as an abrasive person. He is described as a very nice guy. Even if people disagree with him, he's a likable human being. And you know that likability goes a long way in life, And it certainly goes a long way in politics. I think that was the secret sauce of Ronald Reagan, don't you? No matter what you could say about disagreeing with his most conservative philosophies, and when he came on the stage as a Republican, he brought the Republican Party way to the right of where it had been under Nixon and Ford. But people couldn't get angry at Ronald Reagan because he was a really nice guy. And they liked him as a human being. And, you know, we discount that a lot. But in real life, I personally think that that's what matters the most. Are you a likable person? Can you see something from somebody else's point of view? Can you make a joke? Do you have a sense of humor? Can you laugh at yourself once in a while? Anyway, so we've got a fresh start. We have Ned Lamont in office, and we know as a state that we have deferred, we have put aside, we have delayed to our detriment, looking at the problems that are right in front of us every single day. And if I'm talking to you in your car radio, I don't have to tell you. You've been behind the wheel of a car in Connecticut. You know that we have to deal with transportation. So Governor Lamont put forth a 21-point-something-billion-dollar plan over 10 years. The Republicans is 18-point-something-billion over 8 years. You know what? It's pretty close. It's very close. And the major difference between the Republican plan and the Democratic plan does not have to do with the drilling down of specific priorities in bridges and tunnels. It has to do with where is the funding source coming from in order to pay for new highways, better highways, less congested roads, the propping up of bridges, etc. And major transportation like public transportation, buses and trains. And so here's what the GOP wants to do. They say this, and this happens to be true. So remember when we talk facts, you know me, I'm all into the evidence, I'm all into the facts. Right now, we have a 13% budget reserve in our rainy day fund. It is the highest it has ever been. And arguably, among financial people who look at these things, it's too high. Because when you have so much money that you've been collecting as a state in reserve, you are not putting that money to use that it needs to be put to use. In other words, think about this. If you overpay your taxes to the federal government, don't you want your refund? Well, the rainy day fund, in a way, is our collective overpayment of state taxes. Now, it's important to have a rainy day fund. But most people will tell you when you look at your own Board of Finance and you look at your own local town and city, most people will tell you between 5% and 8% is where you should be. That when you get much higher than that, you are wasting the opportunity of this extra money that could pay down liabilities. So right now, because Connecticut did not want to get caught in the mess it got caught in before 2008, we have an all-time high of $2.5 billion in a rainy day fund. And what the Republicans are saying is, okay, and by the way, the last time we were at a high number was in 2008 when we were at $1.4 billion, and that was 8%. Okay, now, what the Senate GOP wants to do is say, all right, listen, we're going to leave $1 billion in a reserve, but we're going to take $1.5 billion out of that. And what are we going to do? We're going to do something that every bonding authority, everybody who's looked at Connecticut's books has wanted us to do for years. We're going to pay down some of our pension liability. We've been promising the state of Connecticut employees amazing pensions. And you know what, dirty little secret? We haven't funded the money to pay for it. So it's looming. They're going to retire. They're entitled to the money. And then what's going to happen? If we pay down those liabilities now, we save interest. We're not paying towards debt. So they're saying, you know what? Let's pay down some of those pension liabilities. And we don't have to pay another $130 million a year that we've had to pay to service the interest on the pension liabilities. Because we're paying back the underlying debt. We're paying it down. And what are we going to do with that $130 million that's already in our budget that we had to use to pay for pension liabilities? We've found some cash. The cash that would have been collected by tolls, we're going to collect in a different way. We're going to take the money that we put aside for a rainy day, and we're going to say, this is our rainy day. Not all of the rainy day, but this is our rainy day. Because we need to do something about transportation. So let's take some of the cream off of the rainy day. And by doing so, pour it into the reduction of other debts that the state owes. Save some interest and take the interest we're saving that's already in our budget. And let's use that towards transportation. That's $130 million. That's $130 million. It's a lot of money. So let's do that. And if we reduce the very ambitious undertaking of Governor Lamont, which he wants to do $21.8 billion, and we make it closer to $19 billion, then maybe we don't need to raise $300 million a year in tolls. Maybe, which, by the way, a lot of people think is an overstatement of what we actually will raise, but maybe instead of the $300 million, we can do it with $130 million. We won't be quite as ambitious, but we'll take care of what we need to take care of, and we'll look at those bottlenecks, and we'll prop up those bridges, and we will increase Metro North times. We will be able to do that. So I'm excited about this. I've been looking at this. I'm excited about this. I think that the compromise that was brought by the Republicans to the Democrats is a very workable starting place. Will they end up in the middle at $19.5 billion? Will they end up in the middle at a rainy day fund of leaving $1.25 billion instead of $1 billion? Yeah, they might. The devil's in the details with all of this. The other thing I like about this is that it reinstitutes something that Governor Malloy let fall by the wayside. And that is this independent state transportation board, which is composed of professionals, engineers, architects, people with self-interest of their own communities and aesthetics, environmentalists. And we have that as another filter, as another vetting mechanism. It's not a port authority. It's not delegating to some other bureaucratic institution the right to levy taxes and levy tolls. But it is saying we want you to look at specific projects. We never should have let that go away. So I'm happy with this. I have to say, and I am optimistic because this is the way government is supposed to work. It's 18 minutes after 10, 203-333-9422. I'd like to have you weigh in. Do you have an opinion about this one way or another? What do you think about this? Also, stay tuned because we have lots of great things coming up right here in our area. Different events I want to tell you about, different movie stars and comedians that are in our community. So if you have nothing to do this weekend, stay tuned. I'll tell you what there is. The Lisa Wexler Show on WICC 600 at 203-333-9422. Welcome back to the show. Before we get to larger news of real import at 203-333-9422, I got to just tell you a side note. So, you know, Donald Trump Jr. came out with a book, and President Trump bragged that it made the top of the New York Times bestseller list. But what I knew, and I don't want to say because I didn't have any evidence, but apparently Page Six has said, and they have evidence, you know, you can manipulate the New York Times bestseller list by buying your own book in bulk and privately selling it. It's an ugly little secret. It's a dirty little secret. It's not the way it's supposed to happen. But you know what? It is the way it happens sometimes. And book insiders noted that Donald Trump Jr.'s new book hit number one with a big caveat because, a source said, it has the big dagger symbol next to it, which means a large portion of the sales came from bulk orders. It's known in the industry as the deadly dagger, a rare penalty that is called for flagrant fouls, such as when an author or someone close buys large quantities of the book. The Times editors can decide whether or not they actually publish the dagger, whether they, quote, plunge it. But their list explains that sales are defined as completed transactions by vendors and individual end users during the period on or after the publication date of a title. Institutional, special interest group, or bulk purchases, if and when they are included, are at the discretion of the New York Times bestseller list desk editors. And when included, such bulk purchases appear with a dagger. So Trump Jr.'s book came out on November 5th. Reports said sales have been boosted by the Republican National Committee, which is sending out copies as a fundraising incentive. Now, that's not the same as when individuals go to stores and buy it because they're generally interested in it. And when you think about the purpose of a bestseller book, you're thinking about, oh, maybe a lot of people are reading this. Maybe a lot of people want to read this. Maybe I will want to read this because the demand for this shows that it's a good book. But when you have somebody as an insider buying bulk sales, thousands of copies, giving it to the RNC, which then gives it out as a promotional book, that's not what the bestseller list is supposed to be about. And that's why when the New York Times recognized Donald Trump Jr. obviously isn't the first person to manipulate, but that's why they have this symbol, because there are authors who will do anything to get on a bestseller list, including buying their own book or having an agent of theirs buy their own book. So an RNC rep, however, told Page Six, "We haven't made a large bulk purchase, but we are ordering copies to keep up with demand. Each book is sold to an individual who supports the Republican Party." And of course, Hachette, which is the publisher, says, "We are thrilled the trigger is number one." But anyway, so I just wanted you to know that little, that's just a little side thing. In the meantime, we have, and I want to go to it right now, we have the former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, who is giving compelling testimony. This is the second day of hearings. They weren't held consecutively. The first was on Wednesday, and there will be more held next week. And Marie Yovanovitch right now is being questioned by Daniel Goldman, the Democratic counsel at the House Intelligence Committee. So let's go to this now, because I know there are people who want to weigh in on the credibility of her testimony and altogether these impeachment proceedings. You're welcome to do so at 203-333-9422. Call me at 203-333-9422.
Where Marie Yovanovitch went turned bad. She started off in Somalia. How did that go? He goes on to say, later in the tweet, is a U.S.
This is Adam right to appoint Schiff ambassadors. Reading from tweets.
First of all, Ambassador Yovanovitch, the Senate has a chance to confirm or deny an ambassador, do they not?
Yes, advise and consent.
But would you like to respond to the president's attack that everywhere you went turned bad?
Well, I don't think I have such powers, not in Mogadishu, Somalia, and not in other places. I actually think that where I've served over the years, I and others have demonstrably made things better, you know, for the U.S. as well as for the countries that I've served in. Ukraine, for example, where there are huge challenges, including, you know, on the issue that we're discussing today of corruption. Huge challenges. But they've made a lot of progress since 2014, including in the years that I was there. And I think in part, I mean, the Ukrainian people get the most credit for that. But a part of that credit goes to the work of the United States and to me as the ambassador in Ukraine.
Ambassador, you've shown the courage to come forward today and testify. Notwithstanding the fact you were urged by the White House or State Department not to, notwithstanding the fact that, as you testified earlier, the president implicitly threatened you in that call record, and now the president in real time is attacking you, what effect do you think that has on other witnesses' willingness to come forward and expose wrongdoing?
Well, it's very intimidating.
It's designed to intimidate, is it not?
I mean, I can't speak to what the president is trying to do, but I think the effect is to be intimidating.
Well, I want to let you know, Ambassador, that some of us here take witness intimidation very, very seriously. Mr. Goldman.
Ambassador Yovanovitch, you indicated that those same articles in March that included the smear campaign also included allegations related to Ukraine's interference in the 2016 election and the Burisma-Biden connection. Is that right?
Yes.
So I'm going to end my questioning where we were before, which was the July 25th call. And President Trump not only insults you and praises the corrupt prosecutor general, but he also, as you know by now, references these two investigations. First, immediately after, President Zelensky thanks President Trump for his, quote, great support in the area of defense, unquote. President Trump responds, I would like you to do us a favor, though, because our country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it. I would like you to find out what happened with this whole situation with Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike. I guess you have one of your wealthy people, the server. They say Ukraine has it. And then he goes on in that same paragraph to say, whatever you can do, it's very important that you do it if that's possible. Now, Ambassador Yovanovitch, from your experience as the ambassador in Ukraine for almost 3 years, and understanding that President Zelensky was not in politics before he ran for president and was a new president on this call, how would you expect President Zelensky to interpret a request for a favor?
The U.S. Relationship for Ukraine is the single most important relationship. And so I think that President Zelensky, any president, would, do what they could to, lean in on a favor request. I'm not saying that that's a yes. I'm saying they would try to lean in and see what they could do.
Fair to say that a president of Ukraine that is so dependent on the United States would do just about anything within his power to please the president of the United States, if he could?
If he could. I mean, I'm sure there are limits, and I understand there were a lot of discussions in the Ukrainian government about all of this. We are an important relationship on the security side and on the political side. And so the president of Ukraine, one of the most important functions that individual has is to make sure the relationship with the U.S. is rock solid.
Now, are you familiar?
That is live testimony right now. Marie Yovanovitch testifying in Washington, D.C., the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, about her experience. Daniel Goldman asking her to react to various tweets and transcripts of that phone call with the President Zelensky. And we're going to return and we're going to speak with a retired general in our U.S. Armed Forces, a general retired, and we're going to talk a little bit about the involvement of the United States in trying to vanquish ISIS and what it all means and trying to put it together on the Lisa Wexler Show, 203-333-9422. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the Lisa Wexler Show. Joining us now, David Pittard is a retired U.S. Army officer. He served as Joint Force Land Component Commander in Iraq from June 9, 2014, during the coalition response to the incursions by ISIS. He was also Deputy Commanding General of Operations for ARCENT. There's so many acronyms in the world of Army military stuff. But bottom line is, he served in the Middle East for a long time. He was in charge of many different operations. He's a major general. His years of service were between 1981 and retiring in 2015. And he's written a recent book about his experience. And General Pittard, hello, and welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show today. Before we get to al-Baghdadi and everything else, I'm very much a current events kind of person. Are you watching with interest the hearings that are going on right now in Washington, D.C.?
Good morning, Lisa.
Good
First
morning.
Of all, thank you for having me on your show. Yes, a lot of interest. I also spent 10 years in the Army in Europe. So the whole situation in Ukraine is a big deal.
Can you explain to us, because you are a lifetime government person, what is the role of the State Department for you as the military? How does the military view the role of the State Department from within the government?
Well, one thing that we mentioned in our book, Hunting the Caliphate, the State Department obviously has the role as far as diplomacy, and we work hand in hand throughout the world. The American power is defined in many ways. It's not just military. It's diplomatic. It's informational. It's economic. And we work hand in hand throughout the world with the State Department. In fact, in many cases, it's our foreign service officers, our ambassadors, chargé d'affaires, who do so much of the business of America throughout the world.
So let me ask you something, and I assume you're free to talk. You're retired, because we interview occasionally military people who are not free to talk. They're not retired. But what do you think of Ms. Yovanovitch's testimony and her feeling intimidated by the tweets of President Trump? Do you think that that was appropriate behavior for the president?
I think the whole situation is just sad. I don't know if it comes to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors, but it's just really sad because Ukraine needed the assistance, the military aid, because they're on the border of Russia, and Russia has been bullying them. Russia took over Crimea and portions of eastern Ukraine, so they're in the fight of their lives, and the hold up aid for what appears to be domestic political gain is just sad.
Yeah, 55 days, incidentally, was the holdup between this conversation and them, or this happening, and them actually getting the aid. Is 55 days significant in your world when you were in the military? Is that a significant amount of time?
It can be, but it does take time to get aid through.
Mm-hmm.
I just coincidentally met with the Deputy Defense Minister of Ukraine in 2017. We're discussing different things for Ukraine. So this is near and dear to my heart, because I met with him in Kiev back then.
We're chatting with Major General David Pittard, retired, who wrote a book called Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Cell. What is the strike cell?
The strike cell is a kind of command and control small headquarters of about 30 people. And at the time in 2014, just to set the stage, at the time in 2014 when ISIS invaded northern Iraq and eventually took over a third of Iraq's territory, we weren't allowed at that time by President Obama to have boots on the ground. And I understood what was behind that and everything else. But so we had to come up with an innovative and adaptive way that we could still support the Iraqi security forces. So we brought in what would be our forward air controllers, or like JTACs, special operations JTACs, from the Green Berets, the Navy SEALs, and Air Force Special Ops, into this control center or strike cell. And in the front of the strike cell were like eight different huge flat screen like monitors, like TVs, where we could see the battlefield through our numerous manned and unmanned aerial systems. And that's how we're able to support the Iraqi security forces with airstrikes.
And when you say unmanned, you mean drones?
Drones, yes. Manned and unmanned.
Okay.
Yes.
Wow. We're chatting with Major General David Pittard, who has written a book about his experiences. And so you have this Dawn of the Strike Cell, which was an innovative way to get around the fact that you weren't allowed to be necessarily on the ground with American troops.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about, so Iraq, we help Iraq. I mean, let's just do a little bit of history, right? We go in and we invade Iraq because we think we're helping liberate them from Saddam Hussein, who ends up in a hole, and literally in a hole. And we find him and he gets hanged in the public square in Iraq. And we expect that we're going to be applauded from all sides, and there's no Sunni Shiite differential. I remember I'll never forget this. I don't know if you know Representative Chris Shays. He served our district for many years. He was a Republican, and he came on this show, on the Lisa Wexler show, years ago, and he said, this whole thing between Shiites and Sunnis is made up. I've been to Iraq. They're good friends. They're good neighbors. Once we go in there and liberate them, it's all going to be Christmas, right, so to speak. And it wasn't, right? It wasn't.
We had
pallets of money. We had Paul Bremer giving out money. We didn't know what the heck we were doing. And in the end, we created a vacuum. And so this horrible, malignant cancer of ISIS spread over the Middle East. So tell us, General, at their peak, how much territory did they control?
At ISIS's peak, which was in 2014, ISIS controlled a third of Iraq's territory and about 25% of Syria's territory. Literally almost went from the Mediterranean all the way to the Iranian border through Syria and through Iraq. Obviously, that also caused strange bedfellows because ISIS was also against Shias, which, you know, Iran is a Shia Muslim primarily.
Right.
So, again, it was an alignment of us, Iran, Shia militias, Iraq security forces, the Kurds, Russia, even Turkey, all against ISIS. And ISIS was very, very aggressive initially. In fact, they literally destroyed five Iraqi divisions. And divisions are 5,000 to 10,000 soldiers in each of the divisions when they took over Iraq's second largest city of Mosul with over 1 million people. So at the time when ISIS took Mosul, that's what caused alarm bells throughout the world. That was like June 9th, 2014. Within 10 days, I was sent with about 300 special operations operators and staff to assess the situation to see if our embassy in Baghdad could hold. A lot of people at that time thought Baghdad would be next and be taken over by ISIS.
So, General Pittard, is it safe to say that had we not invaded Iraq, there would be no ISIS?
Well, you know, that's one way of looking at it, that by opening up that Pandora's box that eventually al-Qaeda in Iraq and the remnants of al-Qaeda in Iraq eventually became ISIS in Syria and Iraq, that one could say it like that. But that really is simplifying it.
Well, because it's simplifying it because the energy and the movement of this hatred had been in place for a long time.
Yes. And remember, Iraq is over, you know, close to 60% Shia, but was ruled by Saddam Hussein, who was Sunni.
Sunni,
in the minority. So it was bound to spill over at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Majority of the people would try to obviously take the country.
Okay, so let's talk about that. So, but the Sunni, you said, was the ally of the ISIS, right? The Sunni.
In many ways. I mean, ISIS was Sunni. However, all Sunnis didn't support ISIS. But ISIS was able to take root in some of the Sunni provinces in Iraq because of the harsh policies of the Shia Iraqi Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki.
Who came in after Saddam Hussein.
Yes.
Okay, so again, you know, we set things into motion and it's the law of unintended consequences and it's a horror. So where did ISIS get its money and its weapons?
Initially, ISIS, in fact, ISIS initially was just one of 1,100 opposition groups or insurgent organizations that were fighting the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad. But ISIS quickly became larger and larger, getting funding from external sources, from people in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and other Sunni nations initially. Well, then ISIS created its own financial means and network by taking over oil fields in eastern and northeastern Syria, by taxing populations that they started to rule. And ISIS literally became the most well-funded terrorist organization in the world.
So they took over oil. Who was buying their oil?
Anybody who could use it in the black market.
Oh.
It's hard to sell oil at all.
I see. Wow. It's not hard to sell oil. And again with Kuwait and again with Saudi Arabia. You know, Saudi Arabia is at the heart and soul of so much that is wrong. It's just incredible to me.
Well, Saudi Arabia, again, it wasn't the government of Saudi Arabia.
Right, the people. But the people have wealth because of the oil. I mean, it all comes down to the same thing, General.
Right. But initially, what they were trying to do was oppose, you know, the harsh rule of Bashar Assad in Syria. once ISIS became this virus, then they stopped getting funding from the Sunni nations because that's not what they signed up for.
Okay. Oh, okay. So they were just signing up to help somebody rebel enough that Assad would go away?
Yes. They were paying for anybody who could get rid of Assad.
Can you talk to us?
The Syrian Civil War, which began in 2011.
So we're talking with General David Pittard, who on Wikipedia, for some reason, your name is Dana, so I wanted to make sure I was talking to the same person.
It is Dana, actually.
Okay. So, General, I'll just call you General. General, so let me ask you this. Can you tell us a little bit about the sad, tragic story of the Yazidi women and what happened with them?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's the Yazidi people, both men and women. A number of things. ISIS really was trying to create and started conducting really a genocide of the Yazidi people. In August of 2014, they surrounded this area called Mount Sinjar, or Sinjar Mountain. And the Yazidis escaped and went to the top of Sinjar Mountain, but were surrounded. It was through our help with airstrikes. It was the Syrian Kurds, as well as Iraqi Kurds, who helped protect them and get them out. We dropped humanitarian supplies in support of them. But what the ISIS fighters would end up doing, in fact, we unfortunately witnessed in one town where they gathered up all the men, women, and children. They put the women and children on trucks. They dropped off the men, had the men dig trenches. We thought maybe we were in defensive positions, but the men were literally digging their own graves. So we watched as nearly 80 men were just murdered by ISIS. We could see that from a Predator drone. But at that time, we didn't have permission to conduct airstrikes. And then the women...
Wait a minute. So you're telling me that you had to be a silent witness to the wanton destruction of innocent civilians?
Yeah, we saw that, unfortunately.
That's Nazi Germany. That's Nazi Germany by the thousands and hundreds of thousands. That's what they did. They lined them up and made them shot them into their own graves.
ISIS was very ruthless. And at that time, again, we happened to have a Predator drone over there. In the book, I relate that, how upset we were. And we said that we have got to, in the future, be able to conduct airstrikes. And then we were given permission after that to be able to conduct airstrikes to protect people.
But the women were then put into sex slavery, right?
Yes. Women were forced to become the wives of ISIS fighters, in some cases sex slaves, as you said. Children were indoctrinated and became like junior fighters. It was terrible.
So where are we, General Pittard? So now it's 2019. The Kurds were at least reported to us as being our allies and friends throughout all of our struggles and battles. And over this summer, it looked to the general American civilian like we turned our backs on the Kurds in deference to Turkey. And then President Trump walked it back, but it was too late. The opening had happened and the Kurds got vanquished. As somebody who was right in the region, tell me through your lens, what happened this summer, and what are the consequences for American foreign policy?
Well, the Kurds, both Iraqi Kurds and especially the Syrian Kurds, were very, very helpful in the defeat of the ISIS caliphate. And the ISIS caliphate was a geographical kind of ISIS nation state. That has been defeated. ISIS, as a very dangerous and lethal terrorist organization, is still around. And so that fight must continue. And the Syrian Kurds were part of that. But one thing with the Syrian Kurds that even back in 2014, what they wanted our help with was to help set up an independent Kurdistan in Syria. We never signed up for that. And we told them that at the time, that we want to work together to defeat ISIS, but we are never going to sign up for an independent Kurdistan. Turkey has always been suspicious of the Syrian Kurds because in Turkey, in southern Turkey, there is Turkish Kurds, it's called the PKK, that's been fighting an insurgency for decades against the Turkish government. So it is a dilemma. Now, how we did it, I don't like how we did it because it looked like we turned our backs on the Kurds. We did it so quickly. We should have done more of a phased kind of withdrawal with joint patrols with the Turks and the Kurds to keep the peace. But again, we never signed up for the Kurds to have an independent nation state in Syria. Also, Turkey is our longtime NATO ally, and so we can't turn our back on our allies either. So it is a tough dilemma. I don't like the way we quite handled it. We could have been much more diplomatic in how we did it.
So, General Pittard, are you you've written this book. It's called Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Cell. And you're retired now. Do you have a view as to ultimately whether or to what extent we'll ever be able to withdraw from what we started in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, or whether we need to maintain always a certain minimum level of troops there? What is your view long term?
I do think that we must continue to be engaged in the region.
You do.
And if we're not engaged in the region, I think some bad things will happen. I do think America is, we are the good guys to an extent. Does it have to be a large footprint like in 2007, 2008 in Iraq where we had 165,000 troops? No. A very small footprint with supporting elements like having air support if needed and logistical support if needed. But it is time for countries in the region to take the onus and do it themselves. That's what was different about this fight against ISIS. It was the Iraqi security forces, the Kurdish Peshmerga, that did the fighting on the ground. We supported them with airstrikes and other supplies, but they did the fighting. That's the way it needs to be. Our footprint needs to be very, very small. In the book, Senator McCain came through. I really have great respect for Senator John McCain, but he kept saying to me, you need about 50,000 troops. And I said, no, Senator, we need maybe no more than 5,000, if that many. In fact, at the time, it was just 1,500, 1,500. We can do this with a small footprint. We do not need to invest a whole lot of American treasure or blood in the region, but we still must be engaged.
Thank you, General. Major General David Pittard on the raid, on all of this, on your thoughts. Congratulations. Thank you for writing the book. And thank you so much for your service to the American people.
Well, thank you, Lisa. Your show, I've listened to it before, is extremely informative. Thank you for what you're doing.
Oh, thank you so much. That means a lot to me, General. Thank you. We'll be right back. WICC 600. The House Intelligence Committee holding hearings today on the impeachment of President Donald Trump. Right now, there is a break in the proceedings. They'll be resuming after House votes. Today, the questioning continues with Marie Yovanovitch, who is the former ambassador to Ukraine, who was the target of various tweets by President Trump and who is no longer in office. And she has a lot to say and has started this morning. So we'll see how it filters. You know, I would like to just mention that the Nielsen ratings came out, and of course, you know, they're never wrong. They say over 13 million people listened to the impeachment proceedings on Wednesday. So I just want you to think about that, because in an average day, Fox News gets about 2.5 million. MSNBC gets less, way less. And 13.5 million or so, 13 over 13 million people paying attention out of the course of their day listening to the impeachment proceedings. That's a lot. It's a lot on an average Wednesday. So I think that more people are paying attention than, generally speaking, people realize. But they're paying attention with half an ear. There's a lot of talking down of what's happened. There's a lot of that. There's a lot of the echoing of the White House that this is a witch hunt. I hear that a lot. I've heard that from you, some of you who have called into the show, not all of you. We hear a lot of, yes, it was wrong, but not wrong to the level of throwing out a president, that something needs to be far more wrong than that, that it doesn't compare to what President Nixon did, which, in case you weren't alive in 1974, President Nixon paid through a slush fund, through hush money, to break into the offices of the Democratic National Committee in order to make sure that he would win his 1972 campaign, which, in fact, he won by a landslide. And there were all kinds of payments tied directly to him and his chief of staff, Haldeman, and all the rest, Ehrlichman and Mitchell and all the people, all the men of the all the president's men, as somebody wrote. And so that plot and that plan and the hush money and all of that, many people are saying cannot be compared to what is being accused of for President Trump. But in the next portion of this show, we're going to return to something that matters to us here in the state of Connecticut. Themis Claridis is the House Minority Leader. She'll be on to talk about the House reaction to Senator Fasano, who represents the Senate Republicans, their counterproposal to Governor Lamont's proposal to overhaul and refinance the transportation infrastructure here in Connecticut. 203-333-9422. I want to hear from you in the next hour as well. It's a Friday, and there's a lot of fun stuff coming up, too. So stay tuned.